Hey, listeners. This is your host, Abir Sichter, here with Local Global Leaders. This episode is titled Community Support, and I had the honor of speaking with Jimmy Chadwell, president of Voices of Hope in Lexington, an organization where I'm also proud to work. Jimmy shares how his own recovery journey inspired him to become a leader at one of our nation's largest recovery community organizations. He also emphasized how radical love lies at the heart of recovery work and the importance of holistic harm reduction. And through all these experiences, he's built Voices of Hope to grow through mentorship, through strong community partnerships, and a simple commitment to believing in people. Now, here's our conversation. Greetings, listeners. We're here at WUKY Radio Studio today for another episode of Local Global Leaders, and I'm honored to have Jimmy Chadwell, the president of Voices of Hope. Jimmy, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's really an honor to be able to spend time with you here on the at the station and talk about our work, so really excited about that.
It's been a great honor for me. For listeners who don't know, my full-time job is at Voices of Hope, so I get to work with Jimmy all day and do this on the side, so just greatly appreciate having you on.
Yeah, thank you.
But to start off, I want to hear your six-word story. What are six words you would use to describe yourself?
Yeah, I tried to frame this in more of a statement, and I think some of this theme will be reflected throughout the rest of the interview, too. But it's, I'm here because of community support.
So I love that. Mm-hmm. That lines up well. And speaking of that, what motivates you to lead in your community?
Honestly, I work in the addiction recovery field, and we'll talk more about that. But I got into this type of work because I thought that it would strengthen my own personal recovery journey. I'm a person in long-term recovery from substance use disorder myself. I saw the opportunity to move up in the company and move into leadership roles at a recovery community organization. I work with Voices of Hope. We're the first recovery community organization in Lexington, and we have one of the first recovery community centers in the state of Kentucky. And I just seized the opportunity when I saw that, basically. It wasn't that I was wanting to come into the community work in a leadership role or anything. I just saw that, tried it, realized that I have some of the skills that help with that the most. And I'm passionate about the work we do, and I think that it is some of the most important work in today's society. It's life-saving work. Recovery support services in general are. And I'm really just honored to be able to lead one of the largest and most impactful recovery community organizations in the United States. And I don't have exact data or, like, numbers on that, but I know impact-wise and the amount of staff we have are one of the largest in the United States, so it's really an honor.
Yeah, and it's amazing, like, how much we've grown as an organization, hearing from starting with, I mean, literally two people to now around 70 staff total, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And as you mentioned, with you yourself, you started from participant to coach to lead recovery coach to manager to program director, and now you're our president. How has each step of that journey shaped the leader you are today?
I'll start with my experience as a participant. So Voices of Hope was founded in it. We've been an organization for about 10 years, a little over 10 years serving the community. I was a recovery housing resident in Lexington, and Voices of Hope came into my recovery housing program that I was in as a participant myself, and I got signed up for what's called telephone recovery support. So they would call me once a week and ask how my recovery's going, ask if I need any resources. And it was just a quick 5-minute, maybe less, check-in call, and it reminded me of the seriousness of one's condition when you have substance use disorder. The drug supply is contaminated. Any mistake or a single use can be your last. And those calls reminded me once a week of the seriousness. I had a stranger that I didn't even know calling to see how I was. You know, that just shows, like, the radical love that's reflected in this work. Like, someone that I still don't know who it was, because I don't think they disclosed that in the calls. It could have been a volunteer. It could have been one of the founders, one of the staff there at the time. And that was in its infancy, too. So I don't know who that was. So if you know who you are, thank you. But anyway, that's how I first got connected with Voices. When I saw an opportunity to work there, I applied to be a peer worker. And I was stationed at a syringe service program in Frankfurt at the health department. And it was really unique, even as compared to other peer work that you may have heard of. I helped to distribute harm reduction supplies and clean equipment to individuals that frequented the health department. And, you know, people hear the word harm reduction, it's like a crazy buzzword now. It's just because people misunderstand what it means. Harm reduction doesn't have to just mean moderating drug use or distributing syringes. It can be you gave someone chapstick because they had chapped lips while they were there, or you gave them fruit snacks and a water so they were a little less hungry and not dehydrated, you know. And those little incremental healthy choices that the people made that I interacted with every day, I saw that build their recovery capital and their just quality of life over time. And it was so small that you might not even notice it. Like that bottle of water and those fruit snacks or the chapstick let me build a connection with the participants. And then we connected them to the life-saving services like treatment, recovery support services, all the things that the community wants to hear. You know, they don't always want to hear about harm reduction, but that can be the conduit or like segue into the services that are really going to save someone's life. That's what I learned from that experience was just the value of harm reduction, the value of evidence-based services and supporting people no matter what and really meeting them where they are. That's what I learned as a recovery coach. And then I moved into a lead recovery coach role where I acted as more of a mentor, trainer, that type of role, and ensured quality throughout the other recovery coaching staff that we had. So it was a lot of training and leaning into that more. Then I moved into a management and then eventually a director role, and that helped to increase my personal professionalism and grant writing ability, a higher level of accountability. I had to be accountable for 30 counties worth of recovery support services at one time. You know, that's a lot of programming. So it was a far cry from just being at a window at a health department or receiving a phone call myself in recovery housing. You know, that made me want to pursue, you know, higher levels of education for myself and better myself even more. And it provided the experience I needed to serve in the role as president today. So I'm super just grateful for all of those different experiences. And don't get me wrong, I've worked really hard myself to get where I'm at, but I wouldn't be where I'm at without the people that have poured into me. Mm-hmm. I had grade A mentorship from different supervisors throughout my professional career, recovery mentors, and they all know who they are. So I wouldn't be there without them. That's why my story, my 6-word story was, I'm here because of community support. So it's really just everyone pouring into me and giving me a second chance. So
that's an amazing story. Mm-hmm. I love how that theme you highlight with harm reduction, like what people don't think of with that. Like, I mean, I remember I shared a quote with the staff from my friend Missy Spears, head of Queer Kentucky. She mm-hmm. put a quote saying, voting is harm reduction.
Mm-hmm.
Like, even
absolutely,
were,
yes.
Yeah. And those examples, it made me think, too, of, like, back when I was a teacher, I was serving through Teach for America in a marginalized area, and, like, kind of a similar thing, like, when my kids were in need of, like, hey, do we have any extra snacks? Hey, like, they need a chapstick, too, or, like, mm-hmm. an extra T-shirt, like, giving that to them. And right. that helped me make that connection with them, like, outside the classroom in a way, and, like, kind of helped me be part of that community too. So it's interesting to hear those themes relating to like other areas as well.
Absolutely. And like I said, it just serves as a way to connect them to really what they need to save their life. And I know that's it shouldn't even be that specific. It can just be giving chapstick for the sake of giving chapstick.
Yeah.
You know, just for the sake of chapped lips or however you want to put it. But the life-saving piece is like when they get connected to recovery support, treatment, medications,
yeah.
things like that.
Yeah.
So.
And I like, yeah, telephone recovery support calls. Like, I mean, we, like, Chris and I work with volunteers and doing that. Just, like, I love that you emphasize that, too. It's great seeing the people receiving them, how much they appreciate that. But also, like, the volunteers, whether there's someone in recovery wanting to give back, how much it, like, empowers them. So that's really
yeah.
amazing to hear.
Absolutely. It's just, you know, another form of servant leadership, you mm-hmm. know. I think that's what keeps a lot of the recovery community in recovery. Even in, like, 12-step fellowships, there's a lot of, you know, helping your fellow recoveree or, you know, however they put it. but there's a lot of that philosophy reflected in recovery in all different types of circles and community services.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But yeah, those phone calls are great. I remember my first week, I got to do some TRS for short, telephone recovery support.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember I was making the call, and I always do my opening joke, introduce myself. Hey, my name's Abir, like the drink. But I realized, I stopped and I'm like, oh, hey, this is Abe. And I'm like, I probably shouldn't say that as an opening joke for someone calling them after the weekend and
right.
being like, this is Abir. And if there's, I'm like, oh, I probably just shouldn't say that if they had a rough week on telephone
right.
recovery support, so
right.
which shows people call me Abe. So, but I remember that was one of my first thoughts of, oh yeah, like, I'll, you know, you gotta approach people respectfully.
Right, right, absolutely. That's funny.
Yep. But with that, like, it's amazing to hear your story, like the mm-hmm. mentorship to the journey to the progress you've made.
Yeah.
I also want to hear, what are some of the biggest struggles you've encountered in your leadership journey?
Yeah, I think these are struggles that I've encountered. And maybe they're just like difficulties, not necessarily struggles per se. I don't know. But this is what I thought of when I saw that question. really, a lot of it is about being diplomatic and being willing to be diplomatic. So as a leader of an organization, you're going to get feedback from the staff, from other management, other members of the executive team, leadership, things like that. And, you know, hopefully there's a feedback loop all the way to the participant, the volunteers, and it, mm-hmm. you know, goes throughout. But really, it's about not shutting down every silly suggestion and you know, thinking through those pieces, not shutting it down just right off, and leading into it with an attitude of being considerate and just diplomatic in general. And it builds trust in the people that you serve, our staff. And I think that trust is key. And I'll talk about that a lot today, just in leadership in general. That is the component that you have to be successful as a leader, in my opinion. And you have to know when to give others ideas leeway or suggestions leeway. You have to know when to be rigid and discern between the two. And also, just having sound judgment and decision-making is hard without the experience. So that's something you have to develop, I think, as the years go by or just different situations occur. And I think that decisions aren't always – so that's like two things, being diplomatic and decision-making. Decision-making isn't always, oh, this is the exactly right decision or the exactly wrong decision or completely wrong decision. It's more, this was mostly a right decision, or maybe that wasn't the best decision. And the only one of those that's unacceptable is indecision. The third one is indecision. So indecision is unacceptable as a leader. And it's important to know, like, not every decision is going to be exactly right or completely wrong. They're going to be graded somewhere in between a B or a D from A to F, you know. I think that's always important to me, because sometimes I'll go home and think, man, did we make the right staffing decision, or did we make the right decision in pursuing a grant? Maybe it was a little right, maybe it was a little wrong, and you want to lean into the more right than the wrong.
Yeah.
So those were things that were difficulties at first and that you just learned through experience, I think. Being ability to be diplomatic and just sound judgment decision making. So
Yeah. I mean, that reminds me of my background in political and policy work. I tell people, like, hey, when you vote, there's two or more choices sometimes, and chances are neither one is perfect, but you choose the one who
exactly.
you think is better or will do less harm.
Like, exactly, yes. Same concept.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I that's one thing I've noticed about our environment, of like how you and the team listen to like all these ideas. I mean, I've loved being able just to pitch random ideas and mm-hmm. go through with them. Like at our
thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
At our community meal this week we had for May, I pitched to Chris Perkins, a volunteer mm-hmm. coordinator who I work for. I'm like, hey, it's Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month. We should do that like theme for the meal. He's like, that's a great idea. And we ordered like pad thai, yeah. Korean steak noodle.
It was a great idea.
Yeah, or some yeah. spaghetti and meatballs to be safe and some garlic bread. But everyone
right.
loved it. Like, we
oh,
ran
great.
Out of the stuff like great. Right away. And the staff loved it too. Like, they were enjoying it. People were coming back for so many plates. But just like having that random, like, I just appreciate having to have that random idea, like accepting that. And I remember for Recovery Awareness Day, I don't know if you knew this, I was saying it as a joke when I pitched one day, oh, we should have one of those wacky inflatable arm tube man guys. But then
right.
I think you went and decided to go and buy one. But
yeah.
I was
yeah.
actually just
yeah.
being silly. Then you were like, yeah, it's a good idea. And I'm like, oh, yeah.
It really
cool.
was.
Yeah.
It really was. So. But that's it. You have to discern if something is silly and helpful yeah. or if it's like silly and we can't use it at all. And, you know, sometimes you even have to like lean into those ones you can't use at all. And it just like generates another like brain trust or like
yeah.
brainstorming. It's just being diplomatic in all areas of work, I think, is key. So
yeah, and it reminds me, like, other people I've worked for not understanding, like, because sometimes I'll have an idea. I'm like, hey, I know this, like, not that I pitch bad ideas, but mm-hmm. I know it's not a perfect idea, but I want to go ahead and say it because I think it'll lead to something else.
Yes.
I've had other bosses who, like, just, no, I don't want to hear it, versus at places like Voices of Hope, it's like, no, let's still hear that idea.
Mm-hmm.
And even if it won't work, we can cater it and turn it into something else that will work.
Absolutely. And I just appreciate your and Chris's working in the volunteer program, all the new innovative ideas and solutions. It's just been A-plus work. So I really appreciate both of you.
It's been great.
Wanted to tell you that on the air here, I guess.
Appreciate that. Official.
Yeah.
We'll clip that quote.
It was great. Yeah.
We'll clip that quote for social media. That will be the title.
There you go.
And I love to hearing about the importance of, like, making a decision, too, going back to that of harm reduction. Uh-huh. Like, it ties into that, too. But I remember a quote from one of my favorite TV shows, Veep, where the administration, the White House, having trouble making a decision.
Mm-hmm.
And one guy eventually says, you have to make a decision even if it's the wrong one.
Right, like, exactly.
You have to accept that.
The only thing that's unacceptable is indecision, in my opinion, at least. So, yeah, agreed.
And going off of the struggles too, like, do you have examples of toxic leadership you've experienced, and what have you learned from those?
Yeah, and it's not as much been like supervisors that I've had, but like supervisors I've worked in with as coworkers, I think, or maybe even supervisors or loved ones that I've just heard stories about. I think that some leaders get hung up in wanting to be like infallible. And they aren't willing to take an arrow for their team. And that's the only way I know how to put it. And I'll explain a little bit further. But I think if you're only worried about your own career's well-being or like your advancement or like just selfish things in general, it's hard to build trust. Again, there's the idea of trust. Like if you can't build trust with your team, you're not going to see much success. I have to be willing to say, you know what, I think that was the wrong course of action. I think that might not have been as clear as it could, my direction, or let me take responsibility for this. I know we had a leadership training recently. I don't know if were you at our leadership training recently?
I don't think so. Which one was it?
With Michael King?
Mm-mm.
Okay. And it may have been before you came. It's been like several months ago. But one thing he talks about is let me hold myself responsible for. And I think a leader has to be willing to do that, but they have to be willing to do it for the team. So like mm-hmm. as the leader of the team, they have to be willing to take an arrow sometimes and say, you know what, that was my fault. I am fallible. I do make mistakes. And then it builds a more humanized trust with the group. And I think as long as you have that trust, then you're going to get the most out of the group, you know.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. And I think that ties in well to, you mentioned, like, you know, you're a fan of servant leadership, but would you say, what is your leadership style or philosophy? Would you say it's that or something else?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think of it as much as like an X and Y or some defined leadership style. It's more of a quality, I guess you would say. So I think it's trusting people to do their job. I think that I need to be willing to be available for feedback and make suggestions, but I need to trust people that they're capable, intelligent enough to do their job and do it well. If I'm the smartest, most capable, most hardworking person at the organization, then the organization's not going to go far. Like all the people that are under me, alongside me, they have to be smarter, more capable, and more hardworking than me, or we're not going to get as far as we can, you know. So I think that's key. And then when they are and you make those good staffing decisions and put good people around you purposely, then that's when the organization functions at an optimal level. And you can trust people to do their job. And you say, hey, please feel empowered to make this decision, take this project on. Again, trust is the theme, I think.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's I love that because, I mean, I know I've had other people say that. I know Vice Mayor Dan Wu, he emphasized that in his interview.
Yeah.
That was one of my first ones. But he mentioned he doesn't want to be the smartest person in the room.
Right.
And as a leader, you don't want that. You want to hear from the best.
Yeah, this is super cliche, but it's like you can go faster if you go alone, but you can go farther if you go together. Mm-hmm. I think it's the same concept. If you have people that have the intelligence, skills, capability, you're going to go a lot farther than you would alone. So
Yeah. And I love that you mentioned a lot about mentorship early on, but that's been important for your career progression and your success in leadership.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of I have these three M's of leadership, being a supportive mentor, a competent manager, and an effective motivator. So how do you see those three separate roles? Do you see them as interconnected or three parts of leadership between motivation, management, and mentorship?
Yeah, I think they are definitely interconnected. I think it starts with being a supportive mentor. Because if people look to you for advice, direction, trust your judgment, then you giving them your attention is going to motivate them to do well in their role and complete their task, be conscientious, all the things. And then if you motivate them, they're going to get the work done. It's going to be of high quality. And then you appear as being a good manager. and maybe that is being a good manager, you know, being a good mentor and motivator. Management kind of gets down into like task and in the weeds a little bit. But I think like first you have to be a good mentor, build trust, then they're motivated, then you look like a good manager. You know?
Yeah.
So
I love that. Yeah, I mean there's truth in that. The appearance of being a good manager
right.
is good management.
Right.
It's like I remember some Supreme Court case, they're like, the appearance of corruption can be corruption sometimes.
Right.
The opposite, right. But yeah.
Right.
And you've had so many, you know, your career at Voices of Hope, so many different achievements and also challenges. What would you say have been some of your proudest successes in your journey so far at Voices?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that it's a few things. The first thing that comes to mind is seeing people. Again, these are people that society completely gave up on. And It's people that had very low general like literacy levels that may have even had trouble reading that we gave a chance to, and they get promoted several times and they learn all these skills on the job. Mm-hmm. And it's just because someone believed in them finally, and just to witness that or be a small part of it. It might be even people that I didn't communicate with regularly, just like seeing from an outside looking in. That has been the biggest joy and success, I would say, is just seeing people grow mm-hmm. like that. And I mean, people moving into management roles and have a lot of responsibility that like had low general literacy levels. Yeah. I don't know how to put it other than that without being like politically incorrect or something, but it's just amazing to see people's growth and progress. And seeing the organization grow. When I started, we had, I don't know, exactly 10 or 12 employees. And a few years ago, at the height of the Healing Community Study Partnership, we had over 100. We have about 70 now because grants cycles just naturally end. So the number fluctuates a bit. But seeing an organization have that much impact and funders believing in us that much, and the financial stability and sustainment that's come with all of that, people have careers now. They've been here several years. A lot of the grants are for a year, and we always pride ourselves on saying that we're able to sustain a large portion of the grants to keep people employed longer. So we want to be transparent when we – I'm getting a little off track, but we want to be transparent when we employ people that their grants are finite. They might end in a year or two, but we're really proud to say that most of the time we can sustain people's employment too. So just all of that together.
I think. that transparency, that ties in well to your theme of trust and even to like motivation to say like, hey, we mm-hmm. have this limited term grant, but we believe we could make it longer. And like that seems to have
yes.
worked out well.
Yes, absolutely. And you know, sometimes it might be that the grant ends anyway and that we find something else for someone to do that's adjacent to their skill set they built with the grant. So,
yeah. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to remember what event it was at. It was at a Voices of Hope, an event maybe at a conference. But anyway, I heard someone talk about how you mentioned like literacy levels, how when someone doesn't learn like by a certain age how to read or do like math properly, mm-hmm. you can't learn that later. But I actually like I think there is as a former teacher, yes, there is truth in that. But places like Voices of Hope show like you can still make those gains later in life, and that
absolutely.
there's
yes.
other skill sets too. Yes. Like I mean, reading is important. Yes, people can still learn that, mm-hmm. but I think with us, it shows how we just embrace that diversity of people from different backgrounds. Mm-hmm. I mean, I love that. I think like pretty much none of our jobs require a college degree.
Right.
And we have that balance. People who don't have a college degree,
right.
people who do have a college degree, people who have a master's degree. Mm-hmm. But, you know, whether you got that training or leadership through higher education, which is a great way to get it, or through life experience, like right. we just embrace all of that.
Absolutely, yes. And I'll say, you know, a lot of our higher level employees, like in mid and higher level management, a lot of them don't have degrees that apply to their role. I know, like, one of our employees works in finance and accounting, and her degree's in animal science.
Oh, wow.
You know? And I don't know what the exact, like, statistics are, but they say, like, 70% or more of your training you learn on the job, and it's not necessarily, like, an educational background training. Mm-hmm. She's learned, like, almost everything she knows on the job, and she's one of our best people. She's been here for years and years. Just to your point, I think, again, that's like trusting people. Mm-hmm. Do we trust you that you can learn the material on the job here, that you can be sufficient or even better than sufficient at your job just through on-the-job training? I think it's just trusting people again. You know?
I think it shows the great, you know, great when we give people that opportunity. It's funny, I talk with my parents a lot. Like, they had a trouble understanding how we can, like, have different careers. So for them, they're from Bangladesh.
Uh-huh.
They had to choose their careers in middle school.
Oh,
and
okay.
that was it.
Wow.
Like, it's like, you know, I mean, there's Bangladesh is more socially mobile now versus they didn't get like, wait, you changed your major like three times in college? And,
right.
And then even when I told them I'm working at Voices of Hope in substance use recovery, they were like, wait, you haven't like really done public health or that work before. I'm like, I've done mental health policy,
right.
disability work.
Yeah.
So it's not like I had no experience, but they didn't get like, wait, how'd you go from being a teacher to doing policy to doing law to like doing
right.
that? But like, I mean, they see it now, but I think Voices, like for my personal journey, I've appreciated that too, to be able, like, mm-hmm. we embrace people from whatever education or no education background they
yes.
have, like if they have the skills no matter where it comes from,
yes.
we value that.
I should also like clarify what I mean by like lower levels of literacy. I just mean like someone that's not the most comfortable reader, mm-hmm. maybe, or like they have a little bit comprehension issues sometimes. I don't mean like they literally couldn't read at all. Just to clarify what I meant, you know.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
So a big theme of this podcast is looking at both the global and local perspectives in our work. And so with Voices of Hope, how do events happening across the country, but also across the world, shape the work you do at Voices here in Kentucky?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a higher level of political division and polarization than there has been in the past several years. And I think that it makes our work of creating safe spaces and letting people be uniquely who they are comfortably even more important than it would have been. And my hope is that when somebody walks into our recovery community center, that they feel welcome, they feel valued and understood, that they see that they're being served by someone that looks like them physically, or someone that shares the same recovery path as them, maybe someone that shares the same socioeconomic background as them. I hope that they find identification when they come here. And I think that that makes our work that much more important. I don't want to, like, comment on any national or, like, specific global events because it just feels inappropriate. But I will say that injustice is more observable, in my opinion, than it has been as of late, and it's more prevalent. And I think that our mission and our work is just that much more important and needed because of the level of, like, political polarization and division.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely shows. And how does, like, the work we do, how does it help put Kentucky on the map and show both the nation and the world that we're a leader in recovery support and community care?
Well, I will say that I think when people think of Kentucky, they think that we're in the Bible Belt or adjacent to it, at least, and that it's, you know, all the values are, like, very conservative, and that that maybe there aren't a lot of safe spaces for everyone. And I hope that our work is a testament to that, and we can be a leader in that space, and other recovery community organizations can learn from our example and make safe spaces for everyone.
And it's cool to see how many, like, organizations across the country are looking to us. I know our co-founder, Alex Ellswick, was recently in Tunisia on a radio
show. Yeah, it's awesome.
Talking about the work we're doing. Like, that was just amazing.
Oh, it's, yeah. It's just honestly mind-blowing. Even if someone just hears about Voices and hears about that concept, like I said, creating a safe space for everyone, maybe that value is perpetuated there across the world. It's amazing.
Yeah. And I know when I started my role at Voices, I mean, telling people around Lexington, everyone is just like, oh, that's such a great place. Even people who don't, like, work in our field or know what substance, I mean, they know what substance recovery is.
Right.
If they don't work in that field, they're like, I just hear that's such a great place. So, like, it's being recognized.
Oh, that's awesome. That's awesome. I feel like that, too. I think that we are a kind, caring, progressive voice in the community, put it like that.
Mm-hmm. And I know you mentioned, like, recovery pathways. I mean, I love that part of our work. Can you tell our listeners how we embrace the idea of, you know, like, celebrating all pathways to recovery and kind of how that's, to me, not just part of being an organization, but part of leading a movement?
I think it is. I think that all comes back to stigma. Mm-hmm. I think that might be the purpose of celebrating all pathways to recovery. The recovery community sometimes misunderstands recovery paths, like medications for opioid use disorder or harm reduction focused paths, or paths that just don't align with traditional 12-step recovery. And I'm not knocking 12-step recovery. I found my recovery, and it helped save my life. Not knocking it at all. But I think that some of that stigma that's perpetuated by the recovery community and the wider community led us to want to celebrate all different pathways and to intentionally build a space that people can come to and their pathway celebrated and understood. I think that's the purpose behind it. And I hope that through our work, just organically, we're combating that stigma, and that general thought from the recovery community is a lot less than it was years ago, and that people are understanding of different pathways and value that. Listen, whatever helps somebody get up the mountain, we want to help them get up the mountain and prop that recovery path up and celebrate it. I don't really know why it matters what their pathway is, as long as they're seeing success.
Yeah. And I think that highlights, like, all the work we're doing. We have a lot coming on the horizon. Are there any major initiatives or events or priorities you want to highlight for us?
Our Recovery Awareness Day event is coming up on September 5th. It's going to be held at the new Gatton Park in Lexington. If you're not familiar with Gatton Park, it's right behind Rupp Arena. It's a big, brand new, nice park. We're going to have live music, food trucks, recovery speakers. There's a kids playground. There's going to be free food while supplies last. T-shirts while supplies last. Really, it's going to be a sight to see and something that you don't want to miss. It's going to be from 4 to 8, so it'll be an evening event, and that's on a Saturday. So please come out to that. It's totally free. We hope to have some renowned musical acts. So it'll be some people that you've heard of, hopefully. And it's an event to celebrate recovery, celebrate different pathways, celebrate voices of hope, and just recovery in general. So, and we also have a new initiative that we're working on to launch a Kentucky Recovery Education and Work Skills Initiative. And that is a training institute that we have created at Voices of Hope. So we have an annual free peer conference. I think Abir referenced that earlier. And we have a monthly community of practice webinar. Both of those are free, and you can register for both on our website when they're available. And the training team behind that CREW initiative also travels all over the state to provide trainings. You can book them, and there's a training menu that's going to be available on our website. By the time this podcast comes out, it should be available.
Right.
So check that out. We're hoping to strengthen the recovery workforce through that work, and it's something you don't want to miss, and we're really proud of the progress so far with that.
Yeah, those are amazing things, and I'm excited myself for Recovery Awareness Day. And if anyone wants to volunteer, go to our website, voicesofhopelex.org, click on the volunteer tab.
Thank you for the plug. Yeah, that was great.
And with our work, too, it's interesting seeing how there has been a lot of, like, at the federal level and the state level of, like, some funding cuts around substance use and mental health services. How have those impacted our work or not impacted it?
Thankfully, we've skirted right under some of those cuts. We've only had a couple programs that have been minimally impacted by that, so thankfully that hasn't impacted us. I know it's been really strenuous and stressful for other recovery organizations in Kentucky and throughout the United States, but thankfully it hasn't impacted us much, and we hope that if we keep on doing the same work we're doing, that it won't, you know. But I can just say that all recovery services should be funded fully, mm-hmm. and the fact that some of them aren't now is totally unacceptable. Just as a community member, not even speaking on behalf of Voices of Hope, but as a community member myself, it's unacceptable that any recovery services aren't fully funded. And I hope that people adopt that attitude and don't support defunding them, you know. So,
yeah. But I want to ask a last few fun questions.
Okay.
What are leadership lessons that have stayed with you from books or other publications?
One concept, and I tell our staff this all the time when I think of it, the idea of touching something once. I don't know if you've ever heard that term before, but it's always stuck with me. It helps me to remind myself to not get behind. And if a duty or a task comes across my desk and I have time, I try to do it right then as soon as I get it and touch it once. And I think that is a value and philosophy that you can perpetuate throughout an organization you work in. And it's going to help anyone at any level, from a receptionist to a manager to an executive level leader. Mm-hmm. If you have time and your prioritization is where it needs to be and something comes across your desk, to just do it immediately.
Yeah.
And then you don't get behind.
Yeah.
And it just helps out your workflow. And then also the idea of just being generally vulnerable. And that helps me to build relationships, and it helps to create a character. And I don't mean a character like as a fallacy or like something that's like ingenuine. I don't know if is ingenuine a word? Not genuine?
I guess.
Maybe. I'm going to look that up later. But not in the concept of not being genuine, but like building a character as being a leader, like for my staff. So when you hear being vulnerable, it sounds like crying with someone, or like, which it can be, or like sharing a really like poignant story or something like that. But it really can be just walking around the office and talking about something that happened to you this week, or like sharing a story from your upbringing and building that relationship with somebody. Like, that's also being vulnerable. It doesn't always have to be sad. Not that there's anything wrong with it being sad,
yeah.
But like being vulnerable is just like sharing all of you. So when I walk around, and again, it's that building trust thing. When I walk around the office and just say hey to people and just talk about silly things throughout the week, it helps me build the character as a leader and let them know who I am as a person, and also like build trust and build a relationship too. So,
yeah. And who have been some of your most important leadership role models?
Our CEO, Shelley Ellswick, has been a huge role model and mentor for me. She's taught me everything I know about leading a recovery community organization, down to finances, grant writing, some minor things about accounting, and just leadership in general. And it's all through arguing. She's going to hear this and laugh when I say it. It's because we just argue with each other. And I'm just joking. It's not like a mean argument or like in a negative way. We just have different opinions and they collide. And then I learn from that. And that's just like her way of mentoring me, mm-hmm. is challenging my like opinions and thoughts and things. So I really appreciate her there. And then I would say, like, other recovery role models and fellow recoverees, I've learned to be resilient from them. I've learned to always show up for my duties and what I need to do, and just be like unwavering, I think, and really to just trust in the universe or God or whatever you want to call it for this purpose. I've learned all that from recovery. So like when you mix those two, like Shelley taught me a lot about processes and the logistical pieces of leading an organization. And then I've got all these other like philosophical and spiritual principles. And I think the two make for a good combination. So
that sounds like a great intersection.
Yeah.
And we started this interview with your 6-word story. Now I would love to hear your 6-word legacy. What are 6 words you hope people will remember about you when they think about your impact on Kentucky and on the world?
I think it's the other side of the coin, and I'm looking at this from the perspective of like supervisees and people I support in our organization and our participants, and I hope that they say he was always supportive of me. So just like I said before, that the community built me up and got me to where I'm at, I hope that my supervisees, my friends, family, our participants, and even speaking of that, of our organizations, I hope that they say that we were always supportive of them. So that would be my 6-word story and the legacy and hopefully the impact that my work has on the state is that people feel supported and get what they need. So.
Yeah. I definitely hear that from our participants at our recovery center. Like, it seems like they definitely internalize that.
That's awesome. That's the goal. It's great.
Mm. But yeah, Jimmy, thank you so much for doing the interview.
Thank you so much for having me. It was great.
Of course, and I appreciate your leadership and just all the amazing work you're doing.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Mm. That wraps up my conversation with Jimmy Chadwell. Jimmy's journey from participant at Voices of Hope to president of the entire organization is a powerful reminder of how recovery can transform not only individual lives, but entire communities. Through harm reduction, through evidence-based support, and a commitment to meeting people where they are, Jimmy and the team at Voices of Hope empowers individuals to build self-directed lives and reach their full potential. And it's key to remember how this kind of work really empowers small acts of connection that can build trust and that can serve as a gateway to wraparound support, something that I see there every day. To learn more, visit Voices of Hope's Recovery Community Center, or our RCC for short, which is located at 644 North Broadway in Lexington. You can also visit their website, voicesofhopelex.org, that's voicesofhopelex.org, to learn more about our work and upcoming events, including our biggest event of the year, which is Recovery Awareness Day, on Saturday, September 5th, from 4 to 8 p.m. at Gatton Park in Lexington. My next episode drops in August and features Jacqueline Coleman, the Lieutenant Governor of Kentucky. Until then, remember to live local and think global, fellow changemakers.